This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. There were breakthroughs on several seemingly impossible fronts in the 20th century. The Cold War came to a close. South African government ended apartheid, and the violence between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland abated. What lessons can we learn from how leaders address those conflicts? And how can we apply those lessons to the diplomatic challenges of the 21st century? Bruce Gentleson attacked those questions in his new book, The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from the 20th Century Statesmanship. He is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University and joins me now. Bruce Gentleson, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
What's the problem? What were you looking for in this book?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I actually got the idea from what you might call bad guy leaders. I'd read an article once which said it was obvious Germany was going to be unstable after World War I. But the particular form that took had a heck of a lot to do with Adolf Hitler, and you could say the same thing about the French Revolution and Napoleon. So I decided to flip it around and think about where key leaders in a lot of different ways made a huge difference, and to think about that across a range of issues from big power relations to human rights to sustainability. And really got going in that direction.
And there really are differences. I mean, you think about big power relations, then if you have a book called Peacemakers, you can include Henry Kissinger
right
in a book like this.
That's right. And the Kissinger chapter is on Kissinger and Zhou Enlai together, which is kind of a 50-50 relationship, and the opening between China and the United States in 1971-72, which whatever other issues have arisen, it's held pretty steady for almost 50 years. I'm very clear in the book that I talk about particular skills. That one played to Kissinger's strengths. It was by no means an endorsement of his overall foreign policy on Vietnam and other areas. And I got to interview him as well as read the documents on it. And you really got a sense for what it took to make that happen. Sometimes we look back and say, well, of course it happened. But if you'd gone to Las Vegas, you know, the year before, you probably could have gotten pretty good odds that it wouldn't.
Well, so talk about the of course part of it, the fact that in some cases there seem to be forces that make these, if not inevitable, very likely, that China and the United States, a market like China, would not stay closed to a capitalist engine like the United States forever. Something had to happen.
Well, you know, when you and I were younger, we used to refer to that country as Red China. Right. And we had even worse images of that than we did the Soviet Union. And one of the keys was the statesmanship that the two practiced. Kissinger told me the story that when he first met Zhou Enlai in their first secret meeting, the first thing he did is put his hand out to shake hands. And it was because one of the people on his staff who really knew China said back in 1955, in the Geneva Conference splitting up Vietnam, John Foster Dulles, Cold War hawk, was there, and he shook hands with the Soviet foreign minister, Molotov, he of the cocktails, and he refused to shake Zhou Enlai's hand because he was Red China. And Zhou Enlai would later say that was the beginning of building trust, that if we could work some things through, that we could take step by step towards an improved relationship.
But again, talk about the inevitability. In other words, there had to be some will beyond the ideology and beyond the way that the politics would play to a domestic audience in both countries. Some will, at least among the leadership, and some sense that the broader population would benefit by this. What were the forces already in place that would have allowed for that to happen or would have argued in favor of the stronger relationship?
There were definitely forces because I never get into the, great leaders make history by themselves. Right. And so in this situation, there was this triangle between us, the Soviet Union, and China. China and the Soviets were having serious tensions. Kissinger saw that if he got better relations with China, it would help him with the Soviet Union. China had just come out of the Cultural Revolution, which had totally upended things in China, and Zhou Enlai knew that they had to move forward. At home, you know, the famous Nixon goes to China, that Nixon was a conservative. He thought he might win some points that might help him vis-a-vis Vietnam. So you had conditions to work with, but then it really took what the two leaders could do that arguably other leaders would not have been able to pull off.
And talk about that. Now, the particular skills and the talents that these two individual, in this case men, had that brought the deal to fruition.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, they spend leader summits today, not just this administration, but recent administrations. They walk in with their talking points, and they look at each other, and they go through their talking points, and some work's been done by aides. Kissinger and Zhou Enlai spent, like, in the first meeting, like 17 hours together. Some of it was with aid, some obviously with translators. And they had these amazing discussions, you know, about their theories of history. There's one point that Zhou Enlai is trying to make his point about Taiwan. He says, you know, Taiwan has been part of China longer than Long Island has been a part of the United States. And as someone from Long Island, I kind of got a kick out of that. And they traded, and they basically, Kissinger got less on Vietnam than he wanted. China got less on Taiwan. But as Zhou Enlai put it, we're in the transformational stage. And when we can do the transformational, the transactional will follow. And many leaders actually think the opposite. You know, you give me this, you give me that, and somehow the relationship will change. And for big breakthroughs, this happened with Gorbachev and Reagan too, you really have to build the trust in the sense of where you want to steer it together, and then you can haggle over this and that.
Let's talk about another episode that is fundamentally different than this, a couple of the other profiles in your book. Let's talk about Betty Williams and Mary Read Corrigan, the founders of the Northern Ireland Women for Peace.
So this happens in the early 1970s when the Catholic-Protestant violence is really going very high. They called it the Troubles because the death rate was going up on both sides. And there was an incident that happened that involved Mary Read Corrigan's sister and her three children were walking through Belfast in an IRA getaway car being chased by the British, lost control, killed two of the kids, injured the other, and put the mother in the hospital. Mary Read Corrigan, you know, walks out of the hospital. This is before our viral age, and makes some unscripted comments to BBC, and it just struck a chord. And it resonated. Then Betty Williams joined in. And in the next couple of years, they organized a protest movement that didn't solve the issue. It took another 20 years for a peace treaty. And George Mitchell played a big role in that. But the violence never went to the same level. And it really began to change the context that, you know, we haven't worked out the details, but we can manage this. And I use that as a way that civil society and everyday people can have a peacemaking role, even when they... You know, she was a secretary in a Guinness brewery, and, you know, it's not like they trained a lot. And they reached the limits of what they could do because of the lack of political training, but they made the breakthrough that others then built on.
But these two case studies, and there are many more in the book, but I want to stick with these just for another moment, illustrate that the two fundamentally different ways in which change can take place. On a state-to-state basis, you have large political apparatus, and you've got their sponsors and donors who have interest, the industries that, you know, can certainly benefit by open trade with China, et cetera. And that may or may not benefit the American people. And then you have this emotional appeal by someone not part of the system and seemingly not having a dog in the fight apart from their lives, apart from their personal lives, that make a personal appeal to people and break through those structures and say to people, is this really the world you want? And ask that kind of a question. Does that take a particular kind of individual? What was it, just pure chance that that an individual happens to make these comments, or is there something about those people in your mind?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's a match of person, you know, man in moment, woman in moment, that's really hard to predict. You have all these consulting firms out there that tell you how to make things happen, communications firms, and they have their place, but sometimes these things just happen. I talk in the book about one of the things I talk about is bringing personal capital to the table. And sometimes that's, you know, sort of moral capital, like in a Nelson Mandela. You know, in this particular case, they had the personal capital. They had a stake in things. They had suffered personally. And they had credibility in the eyes of the people that they ended up mobilizing. And it wasn't because they had, you know, advertisements on TV or anything. So it's one of the great things about when change happens in society. Sometimes it's unpredictable when things come together.
Well, people like Lech Wałęsa, again, you know, a guy who's actually paid by the state, right? I mean, it says that it's a state-run labor union, and the reason they've got a state-run labor union is because they think they can control it. And then this guy grabs the hearts and minds of people, and things begin to change.
Right, and Poland really was, and that's why he's in the book as well, you know, the first country to start the change in bringing down the Soviet bloc. So I go through a little bit of his history, and there too, he had this personal capital. He was a worker. He had paid a price. He'd been fired. Others come into the story, like the Polish Pope, John Paul II. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's the individual, but I use this as sort of taking off from baseball in the wins against replacement money ball statistic. You know, how many wins does this shortstop contribute to the team compared to every other shortstop in Major League Baseball? So I call it statesmanship money ball. Would have another person in this situation been able to do it and pull it off? And in every case, I make the argument that the answer to that is no.
Gandhi is a very interesting case because here's somebody, we talk about the difference between statecraft and state-to-state kind of politics and institutional politics and then that personal appeal. I mean, here's a guy who was attached to the movement, the political movement, which was nominally a secular Marxist movement or at least a socialist movement. And then they have to take on this great spiritual figure because of his appeal to the people. Mm-hmm. The marriage not necessarily, you know, made by Brahma.
That's right. And he played it. He talked about moral capital and personal capital. He had a huge amount of it. At the same time, he wasn't a perfect person. I use a quote in there that he had some very odd personal habits, which helps us, you know, with this sense that we're not looking for the perfect resume or the perfect
Paul
person.
Johnson, by the way, spent way too much time focusing on those personal habits. But
ahead. Right. That's right. We give him a small place, not the whole thing. That's right. Okay. But I think that it's interesting, too. Had he lived, had he not been assassinated, he would have been a terrible leader of the government because that wasn't his thing. That was Nehru's thing. And so this is a question of bringing different things to the table in different figures that really make breakthroughs happen.
Talk about the lessons that we can learn, if any, in this age. Do they apply or have things? And I think particularly in terms of communication changed so much that anything that might have worked in the 20th century is suspect in the 21st. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. I feel like sometimes we have too much of that. It's never been as hard as today. Mm. And the book's a little bit modeled after John Kennedy's Profiles in Courage, you know, in the sense, but it's global leaders, not American, and foreign policy, not domestic. And in the epilogue, where I try to tie it all together and do draw a lot of lessons, I actually use a quote from Profiles in Courage in 1956, which he's lamenting, you know, the tyranny of communications. So we've been through this before, and the argument I make in each of these parts of the book is there are elements of the strategy that, of course, you have to adapt, but there are core elements to the strategies that can be used today, that the Internet and everything else has changed things in some ways. But some of the fundamentals of making peace and going that direction remain the same.
There's also a fundamental question, too, about whether or not, for instance, we go back to the China example. There was probably an incentive both by the leadership and the infrastructure, the economic infrastructure in both countries, to break through and find a way. And I wonder now, given the politics and the way ultranationalism has taken hold, whether there's anything to be gained, whether any political leader nationally wants to be seen as brokering a deal with the other side.
Well, I think for China, actually, there's a good chance. I think what's happened now is President Xi has consolidated power. In some respects, his right-wing nationalists that want, you know, have this vision of China as the new, you know, hegemon of the world actually complicate his life. And so now that he's consolidated power, this is the argument I make in the book, there are ways in which I think, you know, he wants China to be very important and to continue to gain economically and diplomatically. But there's a basis for a relationship with the United States going forward. There's still a pragmatism there. And there's a lot of China that would like to see that happen. They don't want the disruption of their economy. You know, there's amazing changes happening in the country. And most people in China feel that you've got to keep the waters fairly steady and calm outside to keep going in that direction.
But you also write about Trump and Putin, who have benefited by Putin's, whatever else you say about him, has something like an 80% approval rate at home. They like
I do write about Trump and Putin. And there I say, I'm not predicting here that they'll take this path. I make the point that I started this book before Trump, but that leaders like Trump and Putin make it all the more important to try to have leaders moving in different directions. But I actually make an argument there about Putin may have reached his point of diminishing returns. In the Obama administration, I was doing a lot of work on Syria. You know, Putin has sort of made his point. He's on the verge of another Afghanistan if he stays there, being responsible for stability there, his Afghanistan that Gorbachev ended. At home, the economy, you know, this combination of sanctions and the oil markets, you know, have had their effect. It's not like a democracy, but you recently had a truck driver strike around Moscow. That's some ways more significant than, you know, rock stars saying that they're... So there's some things to work with there. I have doubts that he and Trump can do it, But I try to sort of define a path where it could be done. Whether or not they do it is their call.
And yet, a summit, the improbable, the impossible summit between the United States and North Korea under Donald Trump.
And I worry about that a lot, because when you look at the Gorbachev-Reagan and the Kissinger-Joe Enlai, there were three things that made it happen. Personal trust, managing the politics on both sides, and finding policy common ground. I have real doubts about the policy and the politics, and I have real doubts about these two leaders, both of whom are very thin-skinned and both of whom are impetuous, being able to do a Kissinger-Joe Enlai, or really what Gorbachev and Reagan worked out. And I'm actually writing a piece now to try to draw the comparisons. And it's not a political statement, but I think that, you know, you could imagine them walking in, you know, having the first session not go well and saying this is over and going home and thinking about some very scary options.
And the fact is that in those other examples, Kissinger, Joe Enlai, even Reagan, Gorbachev, both of those leaders, whatever personal qualities they brought, they deferred to their staff, and they had staff brief them and prepare them, and they listened to them. And all the evidence suggests that Donald Trump doesn't really defer to his staff.
I think that's right. The whole meeting came out of the blue. The South Koreans were in the White House briefing his foreign policy people. And he walked into the room. He wasn't supposed to be there, and said, "Oh, I'll go ahead and meet." And they're like, "Well, we thought we had a lot of work to do to get there." So, you know, summits can be very valuable. There was a Kennedy-Khrushchev summit that led to the Berlin Wall and other things. And so this is one that's of great concern. Hopefully we can inject some things to manage it. But it is looming out there as a potential risky situation.
Always good to talk with you, Bruce. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Appreciate it, Frank. Thanks very much.
Bruce Gentleson, author of The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship, and a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Going to do a reading at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tomorrow, and then the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on Thursday. And you can find that at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.